morning. This is the North Carolina Radio Reading Service, formerly known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. I'm Bob Martin. We're here again reading from this week's Independent, dated Wednesday, July 10th, 2019. We start with the new column of the Indie Voices, The Higher Hanging Fruit. On justice reform, it took a whole lot of work just to do the easy stuff. This column this week is written by T. Greg Doucette, who is a local criminal defense attorney, justice reform advocate, and host of a podcast. On July 25th, Democratic voters in New York City effectively elected their next state's attorney for Queens. In a primary night surprise, 31-year-old Latina public defender Tiffany Caban claimed victory over Queens Borough President Melinda Katz. If Caban ultimately prevails, a recount is certainly given the razor-thin margin, and shenanigans seem certain given the city. She'll be the latest defense attorney elected chief prosecutor after campaigning on aggressive criminal justice reforms, joining Razor Rollins in Boston, Larry Krasner in Philadelphia, and several others around the country. That zeal for reforming our absurd justice system has even reached North Carolina. Last year, voters in both Mecklenburg and Wake County replaced incumbent sheriffs with challengers who pledged to end participation in the federal government's ludicrous 287G program, where local tax money is squandered to deputize sheriff's office into IC agents to do Washington's work for it. Durham's incumbent sheriff was ousted, too, in exchange for a career lawman who promised to end the unconstitutional practice of enforcing ICE detainers, a policy of ignoring the Fifth Amendment to instead spend your money holding people in jail for 2 days after a judge had ordered their release. And like Caban in New York, Durham County voters chose a new district attorney in Satana DeBerry, who vowed to bring about reform faster than the incumbent she replaced. In North Carolina, some recent reforms have even featured bipartisanship. In just the past few years, bipartisan majorities in the General Assembly have redirected resources into community corrections, raised the age for when children can be prosecuted as adults, expanded our expungent laws, and then expanded them again. All of these reforms are significant, and each will have meaningful long-term effects on thousands of North Carolinians. But as hard as they were to get through our legislature, the Raise the Age bill alone took over a decade, even with study after study after study recommending the changes. These reforms are also comparatively easy in the grand pantheon of fixes our system needs. Consider Raise the Age efforts to make that change languished for so long that by the time it finally passed the General Assembly in June of 2017, North Carolina had become the last state in the entire country still prosecuting all 16-year-olds as adults. New York was second to last, enacting its Raise the Age legislation 2 months before us. Much harder conversations lie ahead, and legislative prospects are dubious. Take money bail. The practice of caging someone before trial unless they have money is as old as the country itself. Alexis de Tocqueville decried its inherent unfairness in democracy in America, written in 1835. But even though the federal government mostly abandoned money bail when Congress adopted the Bail Reform Act in 1984, our state continues to gauge whether someone should remain in jail before trial, largely on whether he or she has money in the bank. This produces artificially increased guilty pleas on top of disrupting families and jobs. And at some point, we need to reassess how we handle prison sentences. Mention violent offenders and most politicians flee for the hills. But in a four-part series on Medium, a data scientist writing under the pseudonym of Xenocrypt showed how longer sentences for violent crimes, coupled with short but numerous sentences for drug crimes, create an explosion in prison populations that simply cannot go away without significant decarceration. The end result is hundreds of millions of taxpayer dollars invested in warehousing people, long after most have aged out of criminal conduct, depriving policymakers of revenue to spend on more productive endeavors. These are just two examples, with many more alongside them. The work of meaningful criminal justice reform has only started, and bigger battles are yet to come. The next news article, Don't Hate the Player. A federal lawsuit accuses the carry company behind the popular video game Fortnite of tricking children into spending their parents' cash. Last month, the guardian of a California child filed a potential federal class action lawsuit alleging that Epic Games, the carry-based company behind the hugely successful video game Fortnite, takes advantage of minors, getting them to unwittingly spend gift cards and their parents' money on in-app purchases. If the case is successful, it could upend the multi-billion dollar gaming industry, says Mia Consalvo, a professor of game studies and design at Concordia University in Montreal. Obviously, it would be big, Consalvo says. Not only would it hurt Epic Games, a company that reportedly grossed $3 billion in profits in 2018, according to the website TechCrunch, and is valued at $15 billion, but it could have ripple effects as well. It would cause a lot of fear and concern, not just Epic, but across the game industry. Central to the lawsuit, first reported by the Triangle Business Journal, is the question, who is to blame for a child's irresponsible purchase? The parents who gave them access to their credit card, or the game maker who allegedly suckered them into buying? The lawsuit alleges the latter, and it says that's how Fortnite makes its money. The video game Fortnite is targeted at children, says the complaint, which was filed June 21st. Although offered for free and may be downloaded for no cost, the Fortnite game is designed to induce in-app purchases. These games are highly addictive, designed deliberately so, and tend to compel children playing them to make purchases. Neither the lawyers who filed the complaint nor representatives from Epic Games responded to the Indies' request for comment. Released nearly 2 years ago, Fortnite, which is free to download on most platforms, has become one of the most popular video games in the world. As of March, more than 250 million players have joined, and Epic made about $2.4 billion off the game in 2018, this according to the lawsuit. Especially popular is Fortnite's Battle Royale mode, in which 100 or so players are dropped onto an island replete with guns, traps, and building materials. Players then fight in a smaller and smaller area as the storm surrounding the island closes in. The last man, or woman, or unsettlingly anthropomorphic banana, standing, wins. About that banana. Though players can earn it and some other cosmetic avatar options, which Fortnite calls skins, by playing the game frequently and well, they can only obtain others through the Fortnite's item shop with the game's virtual currency, V-Bucks, which can be purchased using a credit card or gift card. The current exchange rate is about 100 V-Bucks per dollar. The rate improves the more V-Bucks you purchase. Like some skins, players can earn V-Bucks by playing the game, but the process is time-consuming. Then players spend the currency on whatever they want. A dashing sushi chef skin and the creepy Valentine's Day limited edition pink teddy bear skin, as well as a pickaxe shaped like a bratwurst, a hang glider modeled after the great white shark with a laser pointer strapped to its back, and an extensive catalog of dance animates called emotes. Editor's note, These emotes are also the subject of lawsuits. Actor Alfonso Ribeiro, who played Carlton Banks in The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, rap artist Terrence, Two Millie Ferguson, and others claimed that Fortnite violated copyright law by selling their dances without their permission. Those lawsuits were recently put on hold to allow their copyright applications to be processed. These in-game purchases are at the heart of the federal lawsuit. Because the process of items are displayed in V-Bucks rather than dollars, the suit argues, it is difficult for players to conceptualize how much actual money they have spent. For minors who may not fully understand the value relationship between V-Bucks and real money, purchasing can be made in a rush and in the heat of the moment, the lawsuit continues, especially if a parent has previously saved credit card information in the game. Only 3 purchases per Fortnite account can be refunded, ever, and the game does not include built-in parental controls to prevent such purchases. The complaint does not mention the age of the plaintiff, referred to as Johnny Doe, nor does it say how much he spent after he downloaded Fortnite in 2018. It does say that the potential class action claim is worth more than $5 million and argues that it should apply to minors up to the age of 17. For those reasons, Consalvo says, Epic may bear some fault. I think there's shared responsibility, she says. I don't think it's all on the parents. This isn't a new problem. Game designers have been confronting it since at least the early 2000s, and especially over the last decade with the explosion of free-to-play games on smartphones. That changed the industry's financial model. The games themselves cost nothing to download, but the in-game purchases have proven lucrative and contentious. In 2014, in a settlement with the Federal Trade Commission, tech giant Apple agreed to issue $32.5 million in refunds to customers whose children had made sometimes large unwanted purchases in App Store games with stored credit card information. That same year, Google settled with the FTC as well, agreeing to at least $19 million in refunds. A class action lawsuit against Facebook forced the company to issue refunds in 2016. Earlier this year, children's rights groups asked the FTC to investigate the social media giant. In May, Senator Josh Hawley, a Missouri Republican, introduced a bill that would ban play-to-win microtransactions, meaning, among other things, a purchase that assists a user in accomplishing an achievement within the game that can otherwise be accomplished without the purchase in what Hawley's bill calls minor-oriented games. In a press release announcing the bill, which Hawley co-sponsored with Democrats Ed Markey of Massachusetts and Richard Blumenthal of Connecticut, Hawley likened these games to casinos. Only the addiction economy could produce a business model that relies on placing a casino in the hands of every child in America with the goal of getting them desperately hooked. A British behavioral specialist has likened Fortnite to heroin, telling Bloomberg last year, once you're hooked, it's hard to get unhooked. Consalvo worries that a bill like this could go too far and crush indie game developers. The baseline market price to download most games right now is free. The only way for a new company to make money is through in-app purchases. So if you crack down too hard, you could make it impossible for new competitors to break through. Probably some game companies have gone too far with how they've monetized things, Consalvo says, but this is really coming back to bite them. But it's going to impact a lot more people than just a few people who might have acted unethically. Sometimes game companies will refund charges when parents complain, which Consalvo says is their ethical responsibility, since they know some of the players are children. The John Doe lawsuit doesn't specify whether the plaintiff's parents asked for a refund, only saying that he wanted to cancel those purchases, but was not allowed to under Epic's non-refundable policy, which limits refunds to three times only. But on two occasions last year, Epic refunded parents who filed complaints with the North Carolina Department of Justice about charges their children racked up playing Fortnite. The North Carolina Department of Justice received 13 complaints about the game in 2018, according to state records. The DOJ says it has received 6 complaints about Fortnite this year, but has not provided them to the Indy by press time. Many of these complaints concern things like hacked accounts, unauthorized login attempts, and so on. In one case, Epic told the state that a person complaining about fraudulent charges on their account had made repeated charges from the same IP address, so it wouldn't refund their money. In another, Epic declined to refund $444 to a parent whose child's account was locked for enabling an unauthorized modification of the software. In other words, cheating. But in two instances, parents of minors said their kids had made purchases without their permission. A woman from Lenoir, North Carolina, told the state DOG on August 4, 2018, that her child spent $1,227.06 while playing Fortnite, and that once her payment information was entered into the game, it was autosaved, meaning future purchases did not require additional verification. According to a letter attached to a report, Epic Games refunded the charges 5 days later. Erica Strickler of West Burlington, Vermont, complained to the state DOG on February the 27th of 2018 that her child had charged $134.90 on her debit card without asking, telling the agency, "I cannot afford this." "My son was sucked in," Strickler told the Indy. She says the addictive game encouraged her son, who was 11 at the time, to continue playing and purchasing items. "I really don't think he could control himself," she said. When Steckler tried to request a refund from Epic Games, she says it was like hitting a brick wall. She sent multiple emails over several days, but says she received only boilerplate responses. Once she filed a complaint with the state DOG, however, things started moving quickly. The DOG sent a letter to Epic 2 days later, and Epic responded within a week saying that the charges on Steckler's card had been refunded. Steckler accepts some responsibility for making her debit card accessible to her son, "but she never thought my child would do that," she said. She thinks Fortnite should include stronger in-game parental controls to prevent such purchases, as well as clearer pop-up messages to let kids know they're spending real money on trivial virtual items and more responsible customer service. Dreckler says she misses the days when you could buy the game and be done with it. And now for this week's feature article, The Triangle Music Issue. The first section, First Language. Scarred but revivified, a popular local band finds the love again. Stu McLamb is nostalgic for his first album as The Love Language, released a decade ago this summer. "It was such a time and place and excitement," he said. "You don't get that chance again." Turning on his little tape recorder and hearing sound back, it was the first time I'd recorded stuff on a bigger scale. It helps that there's so much scrappy, sprawling mythology scaffolded around the self-titled album and the band that made it. 11 years ago, McLamb was living with his parents in Kerry following the splintering of both the band and his relationship. An opportunity to play with the Rosebuds spurred him to form his own new band with Josh Pope on bass, Kate Thompson and Missy Thang on keyboards, Jeff Chappell on guitar, Tom Simpson on drums, and percussionist and guitarist Gordon McLamb. They recorded the album in 2009 that fractured shortly after. Now, a decade later, the original members, except Pope, are playing a July 12th reunion show at Cat's Cradle. Merge Records is also reissuing the debut, which has been out of print for years. David Menconi's 2009 spin review of the self-titled LP phrased the band's beginning efficiently, heartbroken North Carolina boy fashions lo-fi indie stunner at Moon and Dad's, Mom and Dad's, although that narrative bears a second glance, as most mythologies do. McClam still scans as boyish, but he was in his late 20s by the release of that record, with a tangled band history already behind him, most notably with the Capulets, before he began his feature project. Still, there was something about these songs and the band that coalesced around them that felt fresh and, well, just worked. There was a moment when the love language seemed like the torchbearers of the indie, local indie rock scene, flanked by the Light Pines, Ryan Gustafson, Max Indian, and other bands that sparked a propulsive energy, or what McClam describes as a good kind of competitiveness. The distorted lo-fi register of the love language had genuine origins. Recording sessions pinballed between basements and storage units around North Carolina, and married with dreamy, infectious hooks that sensibility makes for the feeling of a messy summer of wine rings on a picnic table and stubbed-out cigarettes in a citronella candle. It's a breakup album, if not exactly a heartbreak album, and the distinction feels important. Rather than honing in on regret and longing, frustration chafes against some amorphous, energetic thing. Mania or joy, maybe, depending on whom you ask. Something that was cool about When We Came Around was that people were figuring stuff out and using less advanced technology to do that. I think there's a charm to that, McClam said. That was something that helped make the music what it was from not being able to overthink it. Mess-ups add a lot to humanity. The band toured nationally before McClam signed with Merge Records at the tail end of 2009, and things began to sour between the band. I think it's a pretty open secret that it wasn't the most amicable split, Thompson said. There were a lot of feelings of, I thought we were all in this together, and then maybe it became clear that it was really Stu's project and we all wanted a little more ownership over it. I think our personal lives started to get a little more complicated, and we were all living in a house together, and just a bunch of dudes. It was magical, and I appreciated it for what it was, but it was also really stressful. After making 2010's Libraries and the 2013's Ruby Red with a rotating cast of new band members, McClam moved to L.A., opting for a fresh start. Last year, he put out fourth album, Baby Grand, which Simpson also plays on. The rest of the band, meanwhile, lost touch. Thompson had stopped playing music altogether and moved to teach abroad for a stint before returning to head up Body Games. And then last year, after nearly a decade of not speaking, a run-in at Hopscotch between Thompson and McClam, aided by a handful of fireball shots and Slims, prompted talk about getting the band back together for a reunion show. Fortuitously, this conversation came just ahead of the 10-year anniversary of the first album. Time heals, Thompson said. We were practicing in this little rehearsal space behind a cup of Joe. And you know that feeling when you're watching your favorite Disney movie and you're washed over with a very youthful juvenile's excitement and warmth? It feels like a reset, like coming home when you thought you could never come home again. I can't speak for everyone, but it feels bigger and more emotionally healing than what it appears to be. The scabs are there, the scar tissue is there, but it's fine. As an album, The Love Language rewards revisitation. Opening track, Two Rabbits, is a warbly cinematic ballad that begins with whimsy before sweeping into a rejoinder about mistakes and wanting to die in somebody's arms. It has all the offbeat poeticism of a Joanna Newsom song, is somewhat lacking the depth of a Newsom lyric, but courses with so much obsessive emotion and harsh cracking confidence that you'd be forgiven for getting to peel away the first layer in search of what's next. Lolita, which immediately follows, is also about mistakes, although in this one, Any regret has given way to a rollicking, aggrieved energy. The love language is very earnest, Thompson says, but it's earnest about someone else's feelings, and I feel strongly about it because it's relatable, and those songs mean a lot to me now. I was giving a performance. It was a truly felt thing. It was sincere, but it wasn't mine. By the last song, the band's animation has placed you in the middle of an emotional capsule so full of highs and lows and wobbling uncertainties that you feel as if the key thread of some original argument has been body-surfed away in the crowd and lost altogether. The final quartet on the last song, Gray Court, closes with a clincher that, in the rearview mirror of a decade, looms larger than maybe intended. Love is built like a diamond, but breaks away like glass. You were the first, and you'll be the last. The next section, blues, the work of their hands. The Blue Muse Project and Music Maker 25 embody the living blues. Embodiment is the bedrock of the blues. They are the chronicles, poetic, brutally frank, or both, of a broad range of experiences endured by forebears whose names were often lost over more than two U.S. centuries. Countless blues songs document the consequences of troubled love and lust or the sweat and strain of onerous physical labor. In many of these experiences, the body, working, resisting, overcoming, ecstatic, is central. Photographer Timothy Duffy highlights this principle in Blue Music, a collection of 60 large tintype photographs of blues musicians published recently by the University of North Carolina Press. The book is one of three initiatives in a year-long celebration of the 25th anniversary of the Hillsborough Music Maker Relief Foundation, which Duffy co-founded not only to document hundreds of aging master blues gospel, Native American, and string band musicians in the South, but also to help alleviate their financial strains and provide opportunities to record and perform. Duffy calls the artists collaborators and old friends, which rings true in the unvarnished, unguarded tenor of the images. Large format tintype photography, made with a camera weighing more than 600 pounds, provides incredible intimacy and detail. When the faces and the hands of elderly musicians fill the 14-by-14-inch frames, the contours of their skin, the wrinkles and scars, disclose topographical maps of rich lives. Turning the pages, we lock eyes with Wilbur Tharp, a pianist for the gospel group The Branchettes, and Vanya Kennard, a journalist married to Carolina Chocolate Drops co-founder Dom Flemons, both of whom scrutinize us with incandescent intensity. The late, great Sharon Jones of the Dap Kings demands that we bear witness to an earnest photograph taken months before she died. Though the faces of Piedmont blues guitarist Algy May Hinton is in softer focus, the sharp foreground of her well-worn right hand testified to a long life of farm work. Duffy records different forms of spiritual communion in three faces with eyes closed: the rapture on the countenance of gospel singer Lena McMay Perry, beatific smile of a guitarist Little Freddie King, and the austere contemplation of Robert Finley. Duffy's lens work also captures for eternity a resolute Captain Luke standing strong one day before his 2015 death from cancer. The companion CD, also called Blue Muse, features a number of the artists depicted in the company of guest musicians including Taj Mahal, Jimbo Mathus, and Cool John Ferguson. The compilation features a previously unreleased Eric Clapton track, a 1995 duet with Duffy on Mississippi Blues, following an opening track that seems a joyful blues seance with spoken word passages from an octet including the legendary guitar Gabriel. Taj Mahal gives a deceptively light touch to Spike Driver blues and the resonant baritone of Captain Luke plumbs the bemused depths of his classy tribute to a stubborn mule, Old Black Buck. Alabama Slim's electric guitar in I Got the Blues rubs against Fleming's string band take on Polly Put the Kettle On, and John Doe Holman's human percussion in Hambone contrasts with 92-year-old Eddie Tigner's full band take on Route 66. Tigner died in April. Willie Farmer's I Am the Lightning heads uptown from Hinton's country blues Snap Your Fingers, and Native American singer Carrie Moran's optimistic gospel song Sing It Louder updates more traditional a cappella gospel from Perry and the Branchettes. While all this documentarian is vital, the blues is a living credential. Duke Performances helps the Music Maker Relief Foundation close out its 25th year with Music Maker 25, a week-long festival in December featuring concerts and other events, including an exhibit of Duffy's tintype. Among seven concerts, Flemons joins Blind Boy Paxton, Jake Xerces, Fusel, and Gail Caesar in Pickers and Storytellers. Zydeco takes the stage with Major Handy, Buckwheat Zydeco Jr., and Neil Sant Partis. A Native American musician showcase features Moran, Pura Fay, the Deer Clan Singers, and Lakota John and Ken. Duffy curates a blues review featuring Ferguson, Alabama Slim, Pat, Mother Blues, Cohen, Fay, and Moran, and gospel concerts feature the Branchettes, Phil Cook, and the glorifying Vines Sisters. The next section, R&B, Ebbs and Flow. The Triangle's hottest new R&B artist forged her own path to virtual stardom. 2 weeks ago, Durham vocalist and producer Ebbs, the artist, announced via her Instagram that her song Say It had just hit 2 million views on YouTube. In response, the ever-watchful Durham personality and longtime WXDU 88.7 DJ Ross Grady tweeted about her milestone. The difficulty of covering the sprawling Triangle music scene is highlighted by the fact that this tune by Ebbs has 2 million views, and yet she has had zero coverage in the Indy, the NNO, the Durham Best Clarion Contest, etc. He was right. We had slept on the song and the opportunity to highlight what few opportunities came up from local R&B efforts that have achieved in the digital streaming age. It was a strange time where an artist can be from somewhere but succeed on a placeless internet. Mostly by word of mouth and a few spins by some of Ebb's overseas DJ friends, Say It exploded online and took on a life of its own. I was shocked, says Ebbs, who is 22 years old. I didn't expect for that many people to be listening to my music. I never thought music would be my first route because I draw and I paint a lot as well. It seemed surreal. By comparison, the viral Durham-grown anthem North Cack by rappers Jay Yamazawa, Jay Gunn, and Con Schmego has leveled out at just over 1 million views on the YouTube after 2 years of nationwide attention and most recently placement in a Nike football commercial. And unlike Ebbs, who was barely 20 when she dropped Say It in May last year, the stars of North Cack already had an established local fan base, following them to frequently perform the song locally and create a craze about it when Say It hit the internet, and Ebbs was doing very little on the ground to support her self-produced single. I don't know if I'd like performing as much as I thought I would, so I kind of took a break from it, she said. Instead, during Moogfest, she found herself on the Roundhouse stage at Parts and Labor playing her beats instead of performing her songs. Months earlier, she had met Roundhouse co-founder Nick Gappa-Wallhauser, who encouraged her to showcase her production skills in one of Roundhouse's experimental beat shows, which she did for the first time at a March 2018 Roundhouse Presents show at the Pinhook. She felt more comfortable in this capacity, and it would take a while before she would reconsider singing and rapping her songs in front of an audience. Miriam Tolbert, a.k.a. WKOK 97.5 FM radio personality Mir Lamb, has been hosting the Carolina Wave Showcase and open mic for the past 2 years. In that time span, she's been promising local R&B acts such as Imani Presley, Trace Falsetto, Emaid Allah, Will Wildfire, and Hasina, matriculate from upstart amateur acts to artists with great industry potential. While most of the artists she worked with have been on more of a grassroots path than Ebbs, gaining local fans through frequent performances, Tolbert sees the Ebbs phenomenon as something useful as well. She's very creative, talented, marketable, and she does a lot of different things. All around, she's dope, says Tolbert. But there are two sides to it. Obviously, you want to be known on a national scale. Being known locally is nice, and you'll get the opportunity to present on a more personal level, and people like venue owners get to see what traction you have. But if those same people see your online power through an ill electronic pass kit, they deal with you anyway. Still, how does one explain why a locally obscure R&B artist managed to rack up so many online listens for one song without any industry help or local backing, or even an EPK? Say it. It's a naturally cool, sexy jam with a downbeat energy in the same soul pop league as leading R&B ladies such as CZA, H.E.R., Kehlani, and newcomer Cleo Saul. Sonically, and by association, it's completely fathomable that listeners would naturally drift toward Ebb's music. She may not be following the traditional local and national trajectory, but there's more than one way up these days. I know what my lane is now, says Ebbs. Before, I was just trying to fit in with what everyone else in Durham was doing, rather than come up with my own original concepts. I put a lot of pressure on myself. Now I'm exploring what I like to hear and what I want people to hear. The next article, Classical, at Home and Abroad. As the universities bring in the best of New York and Europe, our homegrown classical music scene shines. Classical music is a tricky thing. Over the past century, its overriding sense of elitism, the notion that the only way to experience this is in perfect performance by a major performer, has created a situation where the relative merits of a classical scene are often defined more by who is coming to town than by who is from town. We are lucky that the Triangle does well on both fronts, from the world-class imports of the university presenters to the homegrown populism of the Raleigh Civic Symphony and Chamber Orchestra. The out-of-town landscape continues to be dominated by Duke performances in Carolina Performing Arts. Disclosure, the author writes program copy for the Carolina Performing Arts on a freelance basis. Both organizations have existed in various forms since the 1930s and have emerged in their current incarnations in the mid-2000s with missions to bring national and international performers to Duke University and UNC Chapel Hill, respectively. On the classical front, the organizations have slightly different focuses. DP leans toward a chamber and choral ensemble, while CPA generally works on a slightly larger scale. But both have served as anchors, presenting canonical classics alongside newer works from the cutting edge. Next session, DP features a deep dive into Beethoven string quartets performed by ensembles from London and Paris, as well as Jeff Scott's genre-bending Passion for Bach and Coltrane, CPA brings Sarah Cahill to explore four centuries worth of keyboard music by women, and also presents Meredith Monk's futuristic vocal work. While it's important to get a glimpse of what's shaking things up in New York and London, Los Angeles and Berlin, the true engine of the scene is local. We have numerous ensembles covering different corners of classical music. Both North Carolina Opera presents fully staged classical operas. Duke's Chompy Quartet, newly revitalized after the addition of cellist Caroline Stinson, continues to find new things to say in the string quartet repertory. And Malarmy Chamber Players mix historically informed performances of medieval music with eclectic selections from across the centuries, and on and on. The centerpiece of the local classical scene remains the North Carolina Symphony. In recent decades, it has built a reputation for strong performances of orchestra staples, alongside a fascinating commissioning program focusing on works by a younger generation of composers, often with North Carolina connections. The resulting pieces by Carolyn Shaw, Cheryl Kirkland, Snyder, William Brattell, and Andrew Norman, to name a few, have provided thrilling glimpses of where the orchestra writ large is going. The North Carolina Symphony has also been a leader in the orchestral world in presenting soloists, conductors, and composers who are women and people of color. The symphony currently finds itself at a crossroads, though. Longtime conductor Grant Llewellyn is leaving the orchestra. So much of this season's programming is dominated by the most conventional, overdetermined, large-scale symphonic works. In and around these colossi, the symphony is playing 10 shorter works by women. While the intentions are sincere and the selections are intriguing, it feels a bit like female composers are being given secondary status when all they get are overtures or character pieces. It would be great if, just once, the symphony would foreground one of these women instead of yet another performance of, say, a Rachmaninoff piano concerto, regardless of how compelling that performance may be. One local organization that has no problem foregoing a diverse range of voices is the Raleigh Civic Symphony and Chamber Orchestra. The symphony has been around since the 1970s, and the Chamber Orchestra was founded in 2000. In the last 5 years, under the direction of conductor Peter Askim, the orchestra has presented some of the most fascinating and inventive programs in the area. Unlike the North Carolina Symphony or the Chamber Orchestra of the Triangle, the Civic's musicians are almost entirely amateurs, an equal mix of North Carolina State students, the university is a co-sponsor of the group, and community members. Each concert has its own theme based on historical events or created with North Carolina State faculty. For instance, in April, the Raleigh Civic Symphony presented a powerful concert reflecting on the centenary, the passage of the 19th Amendment. Alongside early 20th century works by Ethel Smith and Florence Price, a collaborated with the North Carolina stage design professor Derek Hamm and composer Elektra Verubov on an immersion work using virtual reality and avant-garde compositional techniques to tell the story of the fight for women's suffrage in the U.S. The orchestra was scattered around Stewart Theater, creating an ever-shifting tapestry of sounds, including riffs on Strange Fruit and barrages of percussion, as quotes from prominent suffrage advocates and scenes from the movement flashed on VR headsets. Even more impressive, the Raleigh Civic Symphony has presented a world premiere in every concert in the past 4 years. 16 new pieces so far. While professional orchestras will commission a few pieces a year, that concentration is really unusual, especially for an amateur ensemble. And more is on the way. The Raleigh Civic Symphony recently received a New Music USA grant to commission a piece by Allison Loggins Hill to be premiered in April next year. They'll also be collaborating with the Tift Merritt on a song cycle about Raleigh's now-closed Dorothea Dix Hospital and Cherry Hospital in Goldsboro. Everyone says that they're scared of programming new music, but the new piece is always the piece that people come away talking about, Askim said. Why should it only be the elite group that plays new music? Normal people, community people, should have that experience of bringing a new piece to life. It shouldn't be reserved for people in New York and L.A. and people who went to conservatory. The next section, experimental, live on tape. Local experimental labels record our life and times as no streaming algorithm ever could. For better or worse, every record label paints a portrait of a social time and place. The history of music is littered with one story. Things are happening, and then they aren't. Genre trends die. Friendships splinter. Scene glue people matriculate into grad school. Relationships are self-destruction. Air has changed, and a lot of great music tends to get buried or forgotten in that lurch. It might seem kitschy to make the case for small homespun labels in 2019, but they still provide what no amount of algorithmic junking can, a way to find lost or underreported bands that exist beyond streaming platforms, and also a sense of the historical context that spawned them. Thousands of hyperlocal or internet-based outposts exist for the reason of putting out their friends' music. Intentionally or otherwise, they do the unsexy work of preserving ephemeral corners of music history, which is critical in our current flattened, contextualized Spotify age. Thanks in large part to a small group of reverend heads in Chapel Hill, a rich history of skull-crushing, forward-thinking outsider labels has quietly run for decades alongside the stranger pockets of local music. For left-field electronic music, a currently vital scene in North Carolina, it helps to look back to the constellation of mid-2000s area dance labels like J.T. Stewart's, a.k.a. Stinkwork, Electro Label, Down Low, and there's Freak NC, the clone-distributed free-form vinyl label founded by John Terrell and Charlie Heron. The latter is a mainstay of the area's weird music ecosystem, who now presides with Ethan Clausett over the eclectic Rosemary Street venue Nightlife. Frequent NC bottled some of the more bizarro oddies dance stuff happening in the Carolinas and beyond. It was an era where vinyl was prohibitively expensive, and so-called techno and prankster-ish electronic music were less popular to dabble in. Before the gleeful chiptune of a band like Amanaguchi, there was the pop culture-poisoned arcade glitch of noise band Extreme Animals, which released I Gotta Be Me in 2005 on the label Heron Now runs the label Tone Log in partnership with All Day Records, which he also runs with Clausett, continuing to slide out essential left-field releases like multi-instrumentalist Patrick Gallagher's decomposing synth-slash-guitar masterclass, Eye Teeth. On a similar wavelength, but farther into the beatless and ultra, Ryan Martin is best known for his operator behind Nightlight's annual experimental festival, Savage Weekend. He's also a Def Label curator with his own right, Hot Release, his personal label, that has showcased his worldview and insight into the sprawling natural noise underground for more than a decade. Last month he released Out of Mind, the latest transmission from underground pop linchpin Russian Tsarolog. Chili Tape Warp Dream Pop is the name of the game, and Tsarolog is an expert painter at his easel. His worried yop suggests Galaxy 500 through a haze of broken analog gear and sleep deprivation. It is far more soothing and less terrifying than that sounds. Not everything happens at UNC's backyard, though. Raleigh's inventive new body tapes has done an admirable job of upholding a singular no-trends aesthetic. Its austerity and extreme level of technical consistency in every aspect, from artwork to release curation, rivals any boutique label in America. No NRG by Raleigh Duo body kit poured the fall hardcore, the kitchen sink den of black dice, and its own weird inclinations into a truly compelling brutalizer, one of the finest North Carolina records of the last decade. Recent NBT release, Peace Sign, by Oakland producer SPF, is equally smothering, a gorgeous pounding collection of razor wire industrial pop that sounds wholly distinctive, an impossible feat for the genre in 2019. Outsider labels serve another important function, proving to budding fringe musicians proof that their off-trend anti-narrative idiosyncrasies aren't evil or unacceptable. In fact, they have a rich and instructive lineage. And for fans, it's a world to explore beyond the margins of Spotify. The next section, New Dawn, from Folk Music. Mountain Man's Alexandra Saucer Monique embarks on a solo adventure as Daughter of Swords. The harmonizing folk trio Mountain Man, Amelia Meath, Molly Sherrill, and Alexandra Saucer Monique spun songs that made up the front porch of their house near Bennington College into national success, going on to support such indie icons as Feist and the Decemberists, and releasing their second album, Magic Ship, on the distinguished label Nonsuch Records last year. In the 8 years between the first and second Mountain Man albums, as Meath said about blowing up with Sylvan Esso, Saucer Monique graduated from college and decided to explore other ways of being human on planet Earth. She moved to North Carolina and worked at goat dairies and farmer flower farms, spent time in Asheville living with people who were starting a weaving business, and then moving to the Triangle to work at a library, pouring all that nature and thinking time into Dawnbreaker, her debut solo album as Daughter of Swords. Released by Nonsuch and produced by Meath Sylvan Esso co-star Nick Sanborn, Dawnbreaker is a sleek 10-song collection. It has the affable minimalist glow that fans associate with Mountain Man, paired with Saucer Monique's particularly deep lyrics and impressive vocalism, representing a chapter in local folk music that isn't afraid of the occasional electronic flourish. Just after the album's release, we caught up with Saucer Monique to discuss her solo writing process, the ups and downs of names, and how North Carolina influenced this batch of songs. Indy began by asking, "How did you start singing? Did you go to church?" She answered, "I did go to church. I grew up in a very musical family. Both of my parents majored in music in college. My mom's an amazing flute player, and my dad's a guitar player. They started a music store when they were 21, and that's where I spent most of my time growing up." Then he then asked, "Why Daughter of Swords and not Alexandra Saucer Monique?" She answered, "I kind of think of it as a comfortable distinction for myself. Also, imagine telling everyone how to pronounce your name all the time. It's just a curse of having a weird North European last name. It comes from a tarot card. Number one, the card really resonates with me. And number two, I think it's just a stone cold, awesome name." Next, the indie asked, "How did living in this area inflect your writing process?" She replied, "Longleaf Pines is a really great example. I wrote that song right when I moved to North Carolina and was trying to understand the climate and the plants and the air and the sunshine. North Carolina is overflowing with life constantly because it's damned hot. There's more bugs than anywhere else that I've ever lived, I feel like that roly-poly waterfall of greenery and life and humidity is a part of the feeling of the record. And Nick Sanborn and I were pretty intentional about capturing that sound. And the room had very thin walls. There are things you can hear from outside on the record. I think that process was receptive to the life of the place that it was recorded in. Then Lindy asked, how was working with Nick? She said it was fun. We've known each other for years through Amelia, but I would say that making Dawnbreaker kind of transformed a relationship into a friendship. It was a joyful exploratory experience of following the thread of whatever felt like fun in the particular moment. I feel like you can hear that in the record, like a lot of playful choices that were made. Finally, the indie asked, can you tell me more about your songwriting process? She said, I am a fiend for memory, for melody. Songwriting can look a lot of different ways. The most magical is when you have a feeling that you might have written a song and it comes out quickly, lyrics and melody, pretty well formed. Other times, it's like you send a fragment of a line or monolic idea and then really have to work on it. And I feel like it can unfold in funny ways where you come up with a chorus and then try to write the verses and have to throw them out several times. The shifting of focus whenever you run into a brick wall, trying to come at from a different angle, can help me break through, which is true for a lot of things that people do in life. And now a brief look at the back talk column, Bear Poked. We'll begin with comments on last week's Voices column, in which Barry Sanders wrote about an exchange with a Bayouk barista who was annoyed that Sanders missed the cafe music programming. Minbin wrote, I'm a longtime patron of Bayouk. Your article sounds like it was written by a entitled sorority sister from the Valley who was told her fave Baktique didn't have the color she wanted. Thanks for nothing. Well, that's about it for another week. This has been Bob Martin for the North Carolina Reading Service, formerly known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is designed for a blind and print-impaired audience. And a reminder that this program will be available as a podcast following its initial broadcast. So until next week, goodbye, good night, and good morning.